Chapter 41. No Whining on the Yacht. Those of us serving government today have many more issues to deal with than the Founding Fathers had to contend with. They didn't have to worry about antibiotic-resistant bacteria because there weren't any antibiotics. If they got a blister and it got infected, they were dead. It was a simpler and, some would argue, happier time. They didn't have to worry about cybersecurity. Then again, we don't have to worry about slavery. Then again, they didn't seem to worry about it either. Our founders didn't have to deal with GMOs or nuclear proliferation or airline deregulation or airline safety or the use of portable electronic devices on airplanes or aircraft carriers. You get the idea. They had a very easy job compared to mine. It's not just that there are more issues to keep track of than ever before. Policymaking itself has become more politicized than ever. Every single issue also now has a variety of groups advocating for one position or another. For every line and every bill, there's someone whose job it is to care about that one line in that one bill. There are people in Washington making six figures a year whose entire livelihood involves making sure that the formula for calculating depreciation on tractors doesn't change in the next five-year farm bill, or fighting to protect the Medicare reimbursement rate for a certain kind of kidney procedure, or advocating for the right of Amtrak passengers to smoke e-cigarettes on board trains. The late political scientist James Q. Wilson described it this way. Once politics was about only a few things. Today, it is about nearly everything. No issue is so obscure or frankly boring that someone can't muster a high-pressure campaign to get you to vote one way or the other on it. This means you're constantly deluged with information from lobbyists, from public interest groups, and from the people you represent. Email has replaced postal mail as the main form of correspondence between constituents and elected officials, and it's great that a citizen now no longer has to buy a stamp to share his or her opinion. But it also means you get a lot more correspondence than ever before. Congress receives some 300 million emails a year, and you have no way of knowing whether the person who sent you that email feels really strongly about the issue or just spent 5 seconds clicking on a link they were sent by some advocacy group that generated a message automatically. So there are a lot more issues to keep track of, and there are a lot more considerations determining how you vote on these issues, and you're under constant pressure to do not just the right thing, but the politically smart thing, and also everything you say and do is covered in real time by a 24/7 press corps, and you have less time in the day to talk to your colleagues or do research or just sit and think for a friggin' second. This sounds like I'm complaining, doesn't it? Well, I'm not. As Sherrod Brown likes to remind us, no whining on the yacht. My job is a privilege, and every moment I spend in Washington, an unadulterated delight. Did that sound sarcastic? I'm sorry. I'm writing this not long after Trump's inauguration, and it's been rough. But no whining on the yacht. No whining on the yacht. No whining on the yacht. Okay, here's the bright side. Because we live in such a complex world, and because there are only 100 senators, each senator has a real opportunity to find an issue that is of particular appeal and really grab the ball and run with it. For example, Elizabeth Warren spent her entire career worrying about how average people get ripped off by big banks and other corporations. So when she came to the Senate, she immediately became a leader on those issues. John Barrasso, the Republican from Wyoming, was a doctor before he came to the Senate. So he became one of the Republicans' point men on spreading disinformation about the Affordable Care Act. Just an example. John would occasionally claim that because of Obamacare, the Mayo Clinic had stopped treating Medicare patients, which really irritated me and also the Mayo Clinic, which currently treats 500,000 Medicare patients. When I first came to the Senate, I was ready to seize the mantle of leadership on any issues related to sketch comedy or the Grateful Dead. But in my heart, I knew it was unlikely that I'd be called on to share any of that expertise. I decided just to focus on representing Minnesota the best I could, contributing to big debates on health care and education, building on Paul's legacy on issues like mental health, and figuring out as I went along where else to focus my energy and time. Ironically, my experience in show business turned out to come in pretty handy after all. In December 2009, Comcast announced its plan to buy NBC Universal, a merger that would unite the country's biggest cable TV and broadband provider with one of the world's biggest content providers. NBC Universal didn't just own NBC and Universal Studios, it owned 20-some other networks, including MSNBC, CNBC, Telemundo, USA Network, and Bravo. The proposed deal made me immediately uncomfortable, not just because of its size, but because, as you may recall, I had worked in color television. And I had seen a version of this before. In 1993, during my 13th season at Saturday Night Live, the big three networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, pressured Congress to change the rules that had prevented the big three from owning any of the shows they aired in primetime. The purpose of the rules was to prevent the networks from monopolizing the broadcast landscape. Opponents of repealing the rules argued that if networks could put shows in which they had a financial stake in the best time slots, they would favor their own programs over those of independent producers or demand a share of ownership as a cost of getting a show on the air. The networks swore up and down in hearings that nothing of the sort would happen. It's in our interest to have the best shows on our networks. We want ratings. We're not going to pick an inferior show just because we own it. You'll never guess what happened. After the rules were repealed, not only did the networks start putting on more and more of their own shows, but they gave shows they own preferential treatment. Remember a little hit called Seinfeld, about the continuing misadventures of a bunch of misfit New York Jews? Well, Seinfeld itself was not owned by NBC. It first aired in 1989. But it quickly became the number one show on TV, making the Thursday night time slot following Seinfeld the most valuable real estate on television. And the shows that wound up in that premium location on the schedule were all owned, at least in part, by NBC. Of course, there were a bunch of them because they quickly wore out their welcome with audiences. At the time, I performed at a fundraiser for the Los Angeles Free Clinic with Jon Stewart. John told the industry-savvy audience that NBC had just announced its next post-Seinfeld show. A guy takes a shit on a desk. Fast forward to 2009. Seinfeld is off the air. I'm a U.S. senator. I lost track of what happened to John. Seemed like a nice guy, though. Anyway, you'll recall that Harry Reid assigned me to the Judiciary Committee because basically he had no choice. But as it turned out, being on the Judiciary Committee gave me a platform to share my concerns about the proposed deal. On average, an American household pays $2,700 a year for internet, video, and phone service. Cable companies have increased their costs to consumers over the last 20 years by more than twice the rate of inflation. And historically, mergers of giant telecommunication conglomerates had led to higher costs, worse service, and fewer choices for consumers. I also knew from experience that a new Comcast NBC Universal would have a huge incentive to promote the programming it owned at the expense of the content it didn't. Even if a network was already being carried on Comcast, it had to worry that the new combined Comcast NBC Universal would want to favor its own competing channels. For example, the new Comcast NBC would want as many eyeballs as possible watching its business news channel, CNBC. What would keep Comcast from putting CNBC on, say, Channel 32, next to MSNBC, the Fox News channel, and CNN, and putting its business news competitor, Bloomberg News, in the nosebleed section at, say, Channel 531. Meanwhile, what about other cable companies that needed to carry NBC's programming and the content from all the other networks that Comcast would now own? Couldn't Comcast NBC Universal charge other cable companies more for its content? And wouldn't that cost be passed on to consumers? All this raised a lot of questions, and because the Judiciary Committee had scheduled a hearing on the merger, I would have a chance to ask them. As the hearing approached, I got a visit in my office from Jeff Zucker, then the president of NBC, who brought along Comcast CEO Brian Roberts. The first thing Jeff said to me was, "This will be good for Lorne." That cracked me up. "I don't represent Lorne," I said. "I represent the people of Minnesota." Now, I know that sounds like the kind of dialogue a writer from the West Wing might write for an inferior sequel about the Senate, but that's what I said. Sorry. I was the first senator to come out against the merger, and unfortunately, I wound up having very little company. Ultimately, we lost on this one. Comcast bought NBC Universal, but in part because of my advocacy, the FCC and DOJ placed a number of conditions on the deal. The new Comcast NBC Universal would have to put content produced by competitors in the same neighborhood as Comcast's own content. For example, Bloomberg TV would have to be placed in the same cable news neighborhood as CNBC, MSNBC, CNN, and the Fox News Network. And Comcast, which of course was the nation's largest internet service provider, would have to create an affordable standalone broadband package for low-income customers and people who wanted to cut the cord on cable television and just get internet service without signing up for an expensive bundle. I cite these two conditions in particular because Comcast agreed to them and then ignored them. On the Comcast dial, Bloomberg TV was placed in a galaxy far, far away from CNBC, MSNBC et al. As for that inexpensive, unbundled package, Comcast did create one. It just didn't tell anybody. Hard to buy a package that you don't know exists. Smash cut to one evening in early 2014. I'm at the dining room table reading my briefing materials for the next day. Franny is on her laptop in the living room. "Hey," Franny shouts, "Comcast wants to buy Time Warner Cable." "What?" I say incredulously. "I'm reading here that Comcast NBC Universal wants to buy Time Warner Cable." "That's nuts!" Comcast was the largest cable TV provider in the country and the largest broadband provider. Time Warner Cable was the second largest cable TV and third largest broadband provider. This new behemoth would not only be the dominant player in a cable market already suffering from lack of competition, do you like your cable service? But it would control 57% of the high-speed internet market too. Less competition would mean higher rates and worse service for Minnesotans who already hated paying as much as they did for the service they got. "That's crazy," I said, finding another word for nuts. I immediately called my judiciary counsel and told them to start working on a letter to the DOJ and FCC. This was insane. This was lunacy. This was nuts. We had to stop this from happening. Unfortunately, when my team got the lay of the land the next day, it looked like, once again, I would be the only senator coming out in opposition to the merger. The deal looked like a fait accompli. Part of that was because of Comcast's lobbying might. Comcast has about 100 lobbyists on Capitol Hill, a lobbyist for each senator, more or less. But this merger was so important to Comcast that it had hired virtually every other telecom lobbyist in town. Not to lobby for the deal. Comcast paid them not to lobby against the deal. They just took them off the playing field. I made my case to a number of colleagues, but didn't have much luck. Once again, for 14 months, I was the only senator to speak out publicly against the deal. But over the next year, alongside a coalition of allies like Public Knowledge, Consumers Union, and Common Cause, I continued to fight the merger. We rallied the public, and the FCC received nearly a million comments and petition signatures from people opposed to the deal. And this time, the good guys won. After meeting with regulators and being told that the jig was up, Comcast withdrew the proposed merger. One of the big reasons for the rejection? Comcast's failure to comply with conditions on the NBC Universal deal. In other words, I got conditions put on Comcast's first big problematic acquisition. They failed to comply with them. I pointed this out when they tried to make another bigger, more problematic acquisition, and that helped sink the deal. Over the years, I found myself doing a lot more work on issues of media consolidation and the rights of consumers when they interact with the most powerful companies in their lives, many of which don't offer products like cars and refrigerators, but rather services like cable TV and broadband internet. We've won some enormous victories, like protecting net neutrality, an issue in which 4 million Americans took action by submitting comments to the FCC. We're going to need to keep fighting, though, because net neutrality is in real danger now that Donald Trump is in the White House and an avowed enemy of net neutrality is running the FCC. And because media consolidation continues to represent a real threat to the free flow of information in America. These issues affect every one of us every day. And while I certainly didn't expect that being a senator would mean spending so much time working on this stuff, it's become one of the most rewarding things I do. All thanks to a career in comedy and Harry being stuck with an empty seat on Judiciary.